This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Kendall Dineen. And today I'm talking with Dr. Stephanie Lee about her new book, Ugly White People, Writing Whiteness in Contemporary America, out now from the University of Minnesota Press. Dr. Lee is a professor of African and African-American studies at Duke University and the author of other works such as Playing in the White, Black Authors, White Subjects, and Zora Neale Hurston, A Biography. Welcome, Dr. Lee, and thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So to kick us off, can you tell our listeners a bit about how you came to the project of the book?
Yes. So most of my work has been in studying African-American literature. And in 2014, I published a book called Playing in the White, which examines a series of post-war African-American texts that focus almost exclusively on white characters. These are called white life novels, and they were largely dismissed or not really studied because they focus only on white characters as opposed to the kind of mandate of protest fiction, which was to focus more on the struggles of African-Americans. However, I found that these texts written by Richard Wright, Zora Neale Hurston, almost all of the main post-war Black writers of the time, James Baldwin and Petrie, offer really interesting accounts of what whiteness means and how whiteness becomes this repository for different kinds of anxieties and fears of failure to achieve a certain kind of social standard. And I think all of these writers became, for me, really important theorists of how we understand race, and in particular, how we understand whiteness. So as an extension to that, I thought, well, if I'm looking at whiteness as this meaningful category of exploration, how might that translate into a more contemporary consideration? And what would that mean for white writers who seem to be coming to a more acute consciousness of their own whiteness? So I started to be thinking about, you know, how do contemporary white writers represent whiteness? And it's interesting because I approached two editors with this project, and both were like, yeah, I don't think that's going to work. And so I never had a harder time getting a book published than this one, because there really seemed to be quite a bit of opposition to taking on whiteness so deliberately and so, I hope, you know, vigorously in its limitations. So this is really an extension, I think, of Playing in the White. It's just how do we think about whiteness in terms of white authorship as opposed to Black authorship?
Terrific. Thank you. I actually read Playing in the White for my undergraduate thesis on Giovanni's Room, and I just loved it. So this is very exciting to be able to speak.
I'm always so surprised when someone has read things that I've written.
Okay, so this is a big question, I know, but can you give us a sort of rundown on what you mean when you say ugly whiteness?
Yes. So I'm thinking about ugly whiteness as a way of wielding racial privilege to the detriment of people of color, Often it manifests in terms of a willed blindness to the injustices of history and how these legacies play out in contemporary inequalities. Although the most obvious example, in the example that I start with in the book, is the Central Park Karen, who became, like, you know, not exactly a celebrity, but a point of discussion in a lot of mainstream outlets. Amy Cooper refused to leash her dog in Central Park when Christian Cooper, a Black birdwatcher, asked her to do so. And then she called out the police and was saying that, you know, that he was, like, attacking her. In playing upon this narrative of a white woman in distress being attacked by a Black male predator, there is no reason for her to depict Christian Cooper in this way. And it's just a very obvious display of white power and a refusal to take responsibility for the fact that she was not doing something that is expected of all citizens who are in Central Park, which is to leash their dogs. And so I take that as an opening into representations in contemporary literature of how, you know, white characters wield their whiteness against people of color and in ways that then reify the hierarchies that allow for racial privilege to just proliferate.
Perfect. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about how you chose the authors and the text that you did for this book?
I can't say that it was really systematic. I feel like I gathered, because I was really working on this book for really almost 10 years. I remember writing the chapter on Dave Eggers right around the publication of Playing in the White. So that was like 2014, 2015. It was a slow accumulation of me seeing various manifestations of how whiteness gets deployed in texts. So it wasn't really systematic, and it took me actually a while to be able to see patterns of how there's this kind of recognition of whiteness that's accompanied with a refusal to take action, which helps structure the first two chapters, and then how whiteness gets played out in personal relationships, which becomes the focal point for chapters 3 and 4. And then finally, in chapters, the last two chapters in chapters 5 and 6, how really, like, claiming a form of whiteness and like almost claiming it as a form of real entitlement can just be, in some respects, the most awful demonstration of ugly whiteness.
So let's start with Dave Eggers. Can you tell us a little bit about how you see his protagonists working to try to disavow or unsettle their whiteness while continuing to rely actually on the privileges that whiteness affords them?
So I think the best example of this is his second, text, published book. I wouldn't say I was going to say novel, but I think it actually is his first novel because his first book is a memoir. You Shall Know Our Velocity, which is focused on this white guy, Will, who comes into a lot of money really through he doesn't earn this money. He takes a picture of someone screwing in a light bulb and then he gets this windfall. And it's a really, I think, ingenious way to think through how to handle white privilege, because it's like he's born into this, or he gets this through through no effort or through no merit of his own, right? And so it becomes an important metaphor for how whiteness gets yielded. And I think there's certainly a lot to do with a conflation between whiteness and wealth. And he decides that he wants to give away this money. Like, he realizes, like, there's a kind of unfairness in him having this money, and he decides, okay, he's going to give it away, which is like, okay, he wants to just disavow his privilege. He wants to rid himself of this wealth. And as he goes about this, it evolves into questions of, you know, who is the deserving poor, right? Who are the people of color, really? Because it's very much focused on people of color that he's going to give this to. Who are the people who most deserve to have this money? And in making that judgment, it's another way for him to wield the power of his whiteness, because he gets to make that judgment as to, okay, these seemingly poorer people, or the children or the women who seem most destitute, they deserve it the most. But other ones who seem to be crafty or like deceptive, they don't deserve this money. And so even as he's trying to rid himself of his privilege, he's reifying it through this process. And I think this is actually a really insightful way to think through sometimes the kind of impossibility of being able to equalize that, you know, and to challenge us as readers and as even as citizens to think like, what is the best thing for Will to do? Like, it is certainly an admirable impulse in him to try to share the wealth, right? But how can that be done in such a way that it doesn't come across as a reinscription of his privilege?
I was particularly struck by your reading of this novel, Heroes of the Frontier, in which a protagonist tries to render her whiteness, she says, a blank. But really it operates, to me, I was thinking of like a black hole, because the things that she does sort of are sucking people in, endangering others, but she's still insisting on the sort of nothingness of her own whiteness. Could you talk a little bit about your reading of that book?
Yes. So I think whiteness as a kind of blankness is a really attractive approach to race, because it assumes a neutrality, even though we are not born into neutrality. We are born into deeply unfair systems that have been created by historical injustice. And the protagonist of that novel assumes that she can leave the mess of her life behind and just begin anew, which taps into an old mythology of America that there's always another frontier to conquer and you can reinvent yourself. But of course, this presumes this really profound erasure of the past. And for me, this goes back to kind of one of the definitions that I use as I'm working through these texts. James Baldwin identified whiteness as being this moral choice against history, like a refusal to recognize history. And I think what we see in Heroes in the Frontier is a mother who just doesn't want to think about her own past. Like, she doesn't want to take responsibility for it. She doesn't want to claim her identity as being complicit in these kinds of hierarchical and prejudicial systems. And she has the immense privilege to just escape into Alaska, right? And create herself all anew. But that presupposes that history can actually be left behind. And I think this is becomes one of the main threads of the book, is how do white people grapple with history? And this is something that I think we can see, not just within these texts like Heroes on the Frontier or Super Sad True Love Story, which I think takes history probably most seriously, or the difficulties of contending with history, but we see that being staged nationally, right? Like, you know, opposition to critical race theory, debates in state legislatures about how we teach the history of America. Like, what is the history of America? Can we even talk about slavery without making our students feel uncomfortable? And is that discomfort a disservice to students, right? And so then do we whitewash history because we don't want to contend with the exploitation, the injustices, which were really at the heart of the nation's founding? And so I think what we're seeing is just this real difficulty with white people understanding and placing themselves in relation to a history that is horrific and has led to, you know, rampant systems of inequality, from healthcare to educational systems, and just widening inequality that is just like becoming more and more massive. Part of this is about race, part of this is about income. All of these things are interconnected, right? And so the refusal to just take responsibility and see that, much less take action, is, I think, really at the heart of Ugly Whiteness.
So moving into chapter two, you look at two memoirs in which the authors acknowledge both an awareness that white people are currently benefiting from these systems that you're talking about, right? These past and present racial systems of racial domination, but also a sense of surprise or betrayal that they personally didn't apparently benefit enough from those systems, that they and their families weren't successful in a particular way that they really do expect because of their whiteness. So could you talk us through, I don't know, one or maybe the sort of connection between the two, whatever you prefer?
Yeah, I think both Heartland by Sarah Smarsh and Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance kind of begin with this sense of surprise of this, oh, we're writing these texts because we don't fit into this normative framework of what whiteness means, which means privilege and wealth. And Vance in particular, in that opening chapter, talks about like how he shouldn't have to write this book. right? He shouldn't have to write this because he should already be successful. He should be born into success because he's this white guy. And it's just like, the assumption is that you should not have to be born into struggle, which is like, come on. I mean, isn't that like, is that not the experience of most of people of color, you know? And really like, that's also the experience of like most white people, you know? And so just, it reifies this narrative of whiteness being a position only of entitlement. Smarsh, I think, recognizes herself as feeling like she is a failure. Like she, as a poor working, like if coming from a poor working class family, she feels that she has like her family has failed to live up to this expectation of whiteness, which actually really adheres to some of the work that I did in Playing in the White, like this idea of whiteness as creating a set of expectations that no one can really fulfill. Right, whether it be a heterosexual ideal or an ideal of wealth and education, and she is just kind of trapped in this this failure that she doesn't have the money, she doesn't have the social status. So she recognized some alignment with people of color, though she admits that their struggles are harder. Yet she's not willing to take any accountability for that. And I think the best example of this is when she talks about the Homestead Act. And the Homestead Act very clearly was meant for the empowerment of white people. And it excluded, for the most part, Black people and Latinx people from benefiting from basically free land that the government was providing.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
So she says, okay, well, my family benefited in getting this land, but now my family's been working this land for generations, and so it's ours, right? And so she knows, like, yeah, Native Americans were slaughtered, Black people and Latinx people were excluded from this, but she's not willing to say, okay, I benefited, and therefore there should be some equalizing. Now, I understand there are very few models by which she could give up that land, you know, or give up that right. But she's definitely conflating ownership with her family's labor on the land. And it then calls into question, well, then what does it mean to recognize, you know, the claims of Native Americans, the ways in which people of color were excluded from the Homestead Act? And so she can see that these inequalities are historical and persist into the contemporary period, but she's unable to then take the next step to say, okay, this is how I'm trying to rectify this. So it's this recognition without any meaningful change. I think Vance is more troubling because he admits his whiteness, but then just refuses to see how it privileges him. And when he does utilize his white privilege, it becomes part of a social network that is that he identifies as being tied to a sense of Americanness and almost kind of like a brotherhood. So when his grandmother falls ill, and he's in college, so he has to drive back to see his grandmother who lives hundreds of miles away, right? And he's, of course, like anyone would be, concerned about a loved one. He's very anxious to get back. So he starts speeding, and he goes over the speed limit, and there's some policeman who pulls him over, right? It's a white guy. And Vance explains, hey, my Mima is really sick. I gotta get back to her, right? And the white police officer is like, I got you. Go ahead, go speed, right? And Vance presents this as like, hey, there's this kind of hillbilly network that I benefit from, and speeding is okay because Mima is sick and I need to get to her, without thinking like, okay, this endangers the lives of other people on the road, right? Other people don't have access to this kind of freedom. And it's a very, it's akin to Amy Cooper saying, okay, I'm above the law and I'm going to utilize my racial privilege to get what I want as it benefits me as an individual. And I won't even think about the racial consequences or the racial ramifications of this.
So moving into your third chapter, which I love the whole book, but this was like a really interesting sort of shift, I think, into this Claire Massoud's The Woman Upstairs. So Massoud's protagonist, Nora, tries to sort of reinvent herself through friendships or relationships with a family that she sees as sort of exotic and therefore desirable. How does Nora give us a different understanding of ugly whiteness than the protagonist that we've been talking about so far?
So this chapter is really indebted to bell hooks's idea of eating the other, right? And absorbing this exotic racial other without having to contend with the struggle and prejudice that is a part of being a person of color in this country. So in The Woman Upstairs, Nora really just like falls in love with this family of exotic others, mother, husband, and their child. And she has this really profound romance with actually each one of them. And each one of them provides almost this mirror of who she wants to be, right? Like she wants to be a successful artist. And that's in part why she's kind of in, why she's in love with the mother. She wants to be a mother herself. And she sees their child as this, like she calls him a quintessential boy. And then of course she has a sort of sexual affair with the husband, and she wants to be desired. She wants a lover. So she uses this family as a site of her own desires. And in this way, I think it's important to explore how our sexual desires, our romantic desires are absolutely instantiated through race because we live in such a highly racialized country. And for Nora, it's this blindness to the racial struggles that they have. And also it's a blindness to her own whiteness and to like the ways in which she refuses to see certain aspects of her own privilege and certain aspects of her own story as being imbricated in these hierarchies.
Moving now to your fourth chapter, you look at, the fourth chapter. You're looking at a novel in which this protagonist is yearning to separate himself from history, another aspect of ugly whiteness that you identify. Can you talk about how the protagonist attempts to do this through appropriating or trying to connect himself with aspects of Asian American identity?
Yes, this chapter draws a lot from the work of scholars like Greta New, who pioneered the idea of techno-orientalism, which links Asian and Asian American representation to science fiction and the fears of a dystopian future. The protagonist of this novel, Lenny, he projects all of his hopes for eternal life and youth onto this young Korean American woman. And in doing so, he fails to see her as human, but instead as a repository for all of his own racialized anxieties and a desire for a life free from the responsibilities of history. So Eunice becomes this avatar of a life that is all future, all youth. And in this way, he refuses to see her as someone who is a product of her family, who is a product of her culture. She's almost like a robot, but this beautiful sexual robot for him. And there's just a complete inhumanity that happens in his desire for her, which is coupled with, you know, I think like what is humanity, but the story of humanity, which is history. And because he's not willing to recognize himself as being part of history, he cannot see Eunice as being, frankly, like fully human. So I think this chapter, in conjunction with the one on Claire Massoud's The Woman Upstairs, helps us to see how even in these really intimate emotional and sexual relationships, these racial dynamics play out in such a way as to demonstrate how the stories of the people that we are most intimate with can be denied as a result of these racial narratives that we carry with us.
I really appreciated your chapter about Otessa Mashfeg's My Year of Rest and Relaxation, in which you discuss the appropriation of Audre Lorde's vision of self-care that has sort of separated self-care from, as Lorde puts it, political warfare. Can you describe this for our listeners?
Yes, I have to say, My Year of Rest and Relaxation was probably my favorite of all of the novels that I study in this work. So for listeners, it's just like, it's such a fun and amusing read. So I certainly recommend it. Audre Lorde was a Black queer poet and essayist, and she was writing at a time when to care for a Black queer body was absolutely an act of resistance. Caring for a rich white body, I do not think is an act of resistance now. I think instead this idea of self-care can do the opposite of what Lorde envisioned. She advocated for an increased awareness of the political world. But I think the way that the rhetoric of self-care now is mobilized to encourage a kind of political quiescence, a lack of civil engagement, and it becomes a justification for insularity and willed blindness. It's too stressful to read the news. It's too stressful to know about how, frankly, awful the world is becoming. And so I'm gonna not pay attention to that. I'm gonna take a vacation from the news. I'm gonna just focus on, you know, doing my yoga. And, you know, we all certainly need to take time for ourselves, to eat fruits and vegetables, to exercise. But if it's coupled with a failure to engage socially, I do think that leads to not just irresponsible citizenship, but the breaking of a civil society, like, because we all need to stay engaged. We all need to know who to vote for and why, and actually go ahead and vote and know what the salient issues of the time are. And so self-care, I think, has become very dangerously co-opted by a population that is so anathema to who Lorde was and to who she was addressing. This is also just a really striking example of ugly whiteness, to just reappropriate a tool of resistance for its very opposite.
I will say I bought this book as I was reading your chapter, so your enjoyment of it really comes through. Yeah. I thought this book in particular was interesting because it really shows the way that, and I think you've been, you know, touching on this, but maybe if you want to address it more explicitly, how beauty becomes a part of or facilitates ugly whiteness.
Yes. I mean, I think in this way, I'm really influenced by the work of someone like Toni Morrison and the narrative of her first novel, The Bluest Eye, which explores in great depth, you know, like what makes beauty possible. And beauty is possible through ugliness. And I remember being asked when I was still working on this project and kind of thinking through titles and, you know, what is the best way to describe this sort of behavior? Someone asked me, well, why are you focusing on ugliness? Why are you calling this ugliness? And I think it's because in part, whiteness gets equated so tightly with beauty, and to recognize that this behavior is changeable. Like, you don't have to be white and ugly. You know, like, this is something that can evolve, right? Like, it's a choice to act this way. And so often I think in these novels, especially in My Year of Rest and Relaxation, you can see how the cultivation of physical beauty is itself ugly, because it becomes so self-focused, it's so insular. And it becomes a way to then not engage more broadly with the world around us. Toni Morrison called physical beauty, you know, one of the primary master narratives of our society. So a master narrative being the kind of ideological script that's reflected in racial and gender values. And I think these master narratives are things that we can change. Like, whiteness does not have to be ugly. There's a way to shed this. There's a way to act in other kinds of ways.
I think this leads beautifully into my next question, which is both in your fourth and your fifth chapters, you discuss a little bit how fatness and thinness are weighted with particular meanings in Super Sad True Love Story and My Year of Rest and Relaxation. So in Super Sad True Love Story in particular, fatness or softness is associated, it seems like, by the protagonist with history, whereas this kind of sleek thinness that Eunice has, right, is associated with the future. And then in My Year of Rest and Relaxation, thinness is really central to the protagonist's beauty. And this is central to her ability and desire to sleep undisturbed by the pain and suffering of others. And since I study fatness in American literature, I was really excited to see your examination of this, the way that fatness and thinness can be both made to signify so much. And I wonder if you would like to talk about this a little bit more. I'm just curious sort of what your thoughts are. Yeah.
I mean, I think again, fatness and thinness are so linked to these master narratives of what is beautiful, that fatness is linked to ugliness, which is linked to that which is undesirable. In Super Sad True Love Story, fatness is about like a fleshiness of history that weighs one down and prevents escape into the future. Thinness in My Year of Rest and Relaxation is foundational to the narrator's sense of beauty. It's just impossible for the narrator to conceive of beauty outside of thinness. And that leads to this jostling over power and control, especially with her best friend, about one's appetites and one's ability to restrain oneself and to focus, on just being thin. I think this can become especially infuriating, because even as thinness and beauty and fatness and ugly are such meaningful categories, they take us so far afield from addressing issues of fundamental inequality and opportunity, right? And so the narrator of My Year in Rest and Relaxation is talking to her best friend about men and being attractive and being thin. And it's like, there, once again, there's no awareness of her as a citizen in society, right? Like, she's got to just go to the bodega and not even look at the headlines, because that's too stressful. So the focus is only on this project of thinness, this project of beauty, and it becomes all consuming.
Thank you. Okay, so can you talk about the way that you read white male speech in your final chapter, particularly the way that learners, the Topeka school, seems to suggest that what is needed to right our deeply broken nation is more speech rather than recognizing the ways in which the speech of so many is not absent, but purposefully unheard?
I think the Topeka school offers this really sharp critique of white male speech, which is best exemplified by what I can only call the word salad of Trump, right? This kind of excessive speech that's often illogical, but it's so relentless that it defies organized opposition. I mean, I think, Democrats and many politicians and other people have really struggled to engage with Trump rhetorically, because you simply cannot refute every lie that he asserts. You get lost in the complications of his deception, and then you kind of end up fueling the engine of his madness. So what Lerner suggests here is another way of not really speaking, but of hearing. And so that, like, his suggestion in opposition to this onslaught, this excess of white male speech, is to listen back to what is said, to recognize how violent, illogical, cruel, and dehumanizing it is, and just mirror it back. Just listen back to that, right? Like, not to, like, to almost to play Trump back to Trump. Listen to what is actually being said, because there's really like a fundamental inhumanity there. And that to learn to listen to each other and to ourselves is to hear, for example, that Trump is no patriot, right? He's advocating quite explicitly for autocracy, not for democracy. And his supporters quite deliberately say, right, like quite explicitly say that they are allowing him and even want him to become a dictator. We have to just listen to that, because that is the end of democracy. this singular authoritarian way of thinking and speaking, right? And so, I mean, I think, and this is a struggle that I think journalists have, is like how to cover Trump, how to respond and like recognize the excess of deception and lies that he promulgates, because you cannot go point by point in refuting him. It almost seems to me, it's like, just let him play, let us hear him, because when you really listen, like, it's remarkable how violent, how offensive he is, right? To hear him, for example, say, make fun of Joe Biden's stutter, right? Like, we're not talking about policy. We're not talking about ideological debates, right? We're talking about one man mocking the speech impediment that this man has struggled with his entire life. I mean, like, that's not about politics. That's personal, like, playground battles, right? This is not what we need in a president, right? That's what we expect of a bully who's like a child. You know, this is not political presidential speech. So I think Lerner in this book is really kind of wanting us to just hear and recognize how dangerous this onslaught is, and how to have this kind of speech refutes listening, right? And like, you know, no one has ever accused Trump of being a good listener, right? Like, whereas, I mean, we both need politicians who can speak and who can listen. And Trump just repeatedly demonstrates an inability, not just to listen to other people, to listen to other perspectives. And like, that difference, that celebration of difference, is the heart of democracy. And so he's so clearly advocating for an authoritarian way of being. And it's, I mean, frankly, like, it's terrifying.
Yeah. Well said. Okay, so kind of moving towards wrapping this up, what would you like people to do with the arguments that you make in this book?
Oh, that's a hard one. Look, we live in a wildly unjust society, and we are all complicit in it. White people, people of color alike. And we can't fix everything, right? Like, think we have to act in the best ways that we can. Like, right now, I think that means voting, teaching, trying to recognize the pernicious consequences of whiteness, trying to act in a way that recognizes history. For someone who works in higher education, I mean, I think for me, that means supporting open opportunities for others. And that can mean like ending legacy admissions. It can mean encouraging affirmative action. I mean, I think what we most need to be doing right now is supporting democracy, because I think democracy is seriously under threat. And this is a book that, yes, it's very much about whiteness, but it's also about a fear of a loss of power among a group of people who have been accustomed to being in power. And there is kind of a desperation to hold on to power that is really profoundly anti-democratic. And that I think is really scary. So vote, teach, you know, support reparations, support programs that increase equality rather than, reify hierarchy.
Thank you for that. All right, final question. What are you working on now, and where can people find your work?
So I'm working on a couple of editing projects right now. One is a collection on teaching the works of Colson Whitehead, and then another one, a series of essays on Toni Morrison. I'm still thinking through contemporary African-American literature, but it hasn't quite coalesced into a new monograph that I'm working on. So right now I feel like I'm kind of taking a break and focusing on these editing projects before I launch into the next thing.
Yeah, good idea. I always feel a little bit bad asking that question because it's like, well, you just produced this one book and now I'm asking you, well, what are you doing next? But that's great. So thank you so much again for being here.
Thank you. This was fun.
Good. I'm glad.